Some years ago, when I lived in Maine, we had a work, I didn't live in Maine, sorry. When I lived in New England, we had a work party up in Maine for one of the members up there. Wonderful guy. I always get a chuckle because they called the people who lived in Maine maniacs. They're their own breed up there. They're true Yankees. And this fellow was no different. He had worked his own businesses over the years doing all kinds of things. He was a gun maker. He was a cedar shingle maker. He had a gravel pit on his property. He harvested lumber, actually built his home out of all the lumber that he had milled off his own property. But he had gotten to a point where he was dying of cancer, not just one, but two skin cancers. And he couldn't cut wood any longer himself. And that's how he heated his home. And so he had asked if the church could help. And so we put together a work party, and we had a number of people show up at his property. He had a son that was, I think, around 20, 21. He went out and showed us what field he wanted us to cut trees, what trees he wanted us to cut, and so forth. And several members had brought small chainsaws to sort of clean off the branches once the trees were felled. There was a tractor that he had, but trailer behind it also had a choke chain that you could pull the lumber out of the forest when we cut it, log splitter, all these various things. But there were only a couple of men that had the experience in the tool of using the large chainsaws to bring down these trees. One of these men was a former logger by trade. He'd lived in Maine all of his life as well, and he had earned his living for all of his life cutting wood, cutting trees down. His name was Walter Warren. Mr. Warren is dead now, but he, again, was another one of those true Yankees. And he was a man of few words, which meant when he said something, you needed to pay attention, because it usually meant something. But he brought probably one of the largest chainsaws I'd ever seen. It had a 42-inch bar on this thing. It was huge. And he also brought all the interesting paraphernalia that I'd heard about, never seen in person. He had Kevlar chaps, and in case you don't know what that is, in case the chainsaw bucked back, the chaps would protect him from being cut by the chainsaw. It would bind up the chain. He also had the right earmuffs and face masks and all these sort of things. But the thing that really caught my attention is that about every other tree he would cut down, he would stop, and he would tighten up the chain. He'd put more bar oil in it, and he would get out his file, and he would go through the whole chain, and he would file all the teeth. I realized that as a boy, I had that chore growing up as well. My parents heated a fair amount of their house with a wood stove, and I would cut wood at times, but I would sharpen the chain on a chainsaw maybe once or twice a season. I quickly realized I'd been doing that wrong my whole life up to that point. Because Mr. Warren stopped and sharpened his chain so frequently, he was actually able to cut more wood quicker and safer, because he knew what it was going to do. Some years ago, a couple of decades, there was a popular adage that started in the business world, talked about working harder. And of course, that was sort of selfish from the business community, right? They wanted more productivity out of the workers. And it was realized that most people realized the folly of that, so they shifted it to work smarter, not just harder, which had some advantages. You don't have to work hard all the time. You can work smart about it. Because a person can work hard and still not get ahead and still not be smart about it. And maybe you've seen this even in your life. And I want to sort of tie those two thoughts together, those two illustrations, and talk about the principle of sharpening the axe. And that's simply my title today, Sharpening the Axe, and how we can apply that in our spiritual life. Oftentimes, we can become so focused in our work that we forget the value of working the smartest way we can. In the job, I think I've related some of this previously in other sermons years ago. The job I had before becoming a pastor, I was a one-man show. Industries change, especially with computer technology. When I started out in the graphics industry, the job I was doing when I was hired by the church was probably about five people that took to do that job. But with computer technology, one person could do all that work now. And the work that I did was catalog work for a company that sold warehouse-type equipment. And those catalogs were printed in early June, and so our ramp-up started back in January, and I had to have them done by the end of May so they could be printed. And the closer I got to June, the busier I got, because those deadlines are unforgiving. You have to meet them, or it might be months before you would have the press time again. And so I would do all kinds of work being flat out, but after June, my work would drop off significantly. The big job was done, and I didn't have to start on that again until the next January. And so I used that time to color correct photos. Some of this may or may not mean anything to you depending on what business you're in, but my predecessor had never corrected any of the color on the photos, which meant you were trying to correct it when you're printing it. Now, anybody that prints knows that's not an easy job, because at the very minimum, you're printing 4 pages at a time. On the press runs that I was doing, we were printing 24 pages at a time. And so if you can imagine 24 pages lined up, if you're trying to correct color on something here, you're going to affect all that follows on the cylinder. And so it becomes this battle of trying to balance these things out. Well, if you have the best possible photo to begin with, it makes that color compensation and correcting so much easier to do. So I would do that. I would file my photos. Sometimes my boss would come in and he'd say, I want a rerun, a product we had 3 years ago. And I would say, I don't know where that photo is. And I have to go and dig through all the files to find that photo. They were never cataloged. So I would catalog the photos. I would back up the files. The one thing that was truly astounding when I took over the position was that previously, when the files were all done and ready to go to the printer, now, this is back when they had SideQuest drives and some of these big external drives, he would package up all of his external drives into a box, and he would ship them off to the printer. No backups. He was at the mercy of FedEx. If they ever lost his files, there was no catalog being printed. So I established a backup system to be able to do that, and it saved me more than once. I would organize photo shoots upcoming, that I, products that I knew we needed the next year, or files that weren't very good, and I would get new photos from the manufacturers, things of this nature. The point is that I did as much as I could in the off-season, so I wasn't distracted by those things when I was really busy and in the thick of trying to put these catalogs together, which made it all easier than the subsequent years. This aspect of working smarter can evolve or involve various things down through time. I've worked for other companies that saw employees as simply another expense. Maybe some of you have experienced that. Employees are expendable, disposable, and so they expect employees to work long hours, to work overtime with no pay, or any number of things that can be put to task. But one of the common things is that your time outside of work really doesn't matter. What matters is what you can do at work, and they want as much of that time as possible. The net result in almost every case is that they burn people out. And that's unfortunate, because that turnover is not just costly in terms of hiring, it's costly in the brain drain. The wisdom and experience that you develop in people, that you've actually paid them to learn, now walks out the door and benefits somebody else. When everything is go, 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 there's no chance to breathe, to take a step back and assess what's working, what's not, what we can do better, what we can adjust, so that we're ready for the next round, if you will. And so the concept over the years has become, and it's still extant in the world around us, it's shifted a little bit, but that downtime is not seen as good time to prepare. Downtime is seen as wasted time. Medical science, though, sees some of this differently. It's catching up with God's word in some ways, and that is in the principle of a Sabbath rest. Human bodies cannot go nonstop. They need a break. That's really no different than anything else in life. You can't run anything 24 hours without it burning out. And so we need proper sleep and rest. We need time to recharge, time to break up the routine so that we have a mental break as well. Let's, by way of reminder, go back and read Exodus 20 and in the commandments that God gave Israel. It's unfortunate that so many see these commandments as a list of don'ts, and they don't see the value in what God has in mind in terms of the spiritual principle, and even physically, the blessings that come from following his word. God gave us the Sabbath day. In fact, Christ reminded the Pharisees of his day, the Sabbath was made for man, not the other way around. We don't serve the Sabbath. the Sabbath is for us as a blessing. And God gives us 52 opportunities a year to have a break from the world, not even counting the holy days. At the very minimum, we have 52 times a year to stop and to just simply reshift. So in Exodus 20 in verse 8, we have here the fourth commandment regarding the Sabbath. And so God says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shall you labor and do all your work. Doesn't mean we have to be flat out the 6 days, but whatever we want to accomplish, we have 6 days to do it. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of your Lord, the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, meaning the principle here is no common work, no work that we can get done the other 6 days, no work that is driven by what we want. In it you shall do no work, you or your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your cattle, your stranger, who is within your gates. Whatever we have under our control. And you can say, well, I don't have much under my control. Well, we do. We don't have to take our car in to get serviced over the Sabbath. If somebody's painting our house, we can tell them we don't want them working on the Sabbath. Things of this nature. We don't have to obligate other people to take care of us on the Sabbath day. And so verse 11, in 6 days the Eternal made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them and rested on the seventh day, which is very interesting. Does God need to rest? Not in the same way we do, right? He's not physical. He doesn't need to go take a nap. He doesn't need to break that routine in the same way. But there's a principle, even spiritually, of shifting gears and taking time to pause and consider other things. God set that example for us. He rested in the seventh day. Therefore, the Eternal blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy because he's in it. Now, this is, in many ways, a reference back to Genesis 2, after God recreated the face of the earth, and it says that he rested. This is what's being quoted and referenced here, that God took a time to step back, even after he created all that we're familiar with now, and he took time to pause and consider it all and to set an example for us. So what does it mean to rest on the Sabbath day? Some of it can be obvious. There's certainly the physical component of rest in the day. It's nice to be able to have that day to sleep in, to have a more leisurely breakfast or a brunch, or to have the extra time to not feel just rushed in whatever we do. That's important, if nothing else, for our mental health, but also physically. That break allows our body then to recover, if you will, from the stress of the week. It is ideal that we get the rest we need every night, but if we don't, at least one day a week, we potentially can, because as we expend that energy, obviously that energy level goes down. And physically, and even mentally, we create waste products, and the body needs to process that so that we can be rejuvenated and restored. The important difference between physical and mental activity is that physical activity usually leaves the muscles relaxed, right? We're just spent. Whereas mental activity leaves the muscles tense. So you need different rest for the two different components. But rest and sleep are dependent upon our ability to relax. That's the problem many people face, and it seems to be mostly a problem women face, is they can't shut their mind off. How do I relax? I don't say that as a derogatory statement. It's just something about the way God designed women. They ruminate on things more. But a person that is tense is not relaxing, and therefore they can't really rest. On a personal level, probably a lot of us saw some of this in the past 15 or more months as COVID impacted the state, the cities, the governments around us. Back in March of 2020, the state of Wisconsin shut down, as most states and even this government of the nation did. And so everyone's work shifted dramatically, didn't it? If they were still working, almost everyone worked from home still. There were a few that still went into offices, but that wasn't the norm. It was really odd to go out at normal rush hour times on the highway and see how empty it was. Pay attention to those things, and it even shifted my work around. Normally, I only work about half a day on the Sabbath, from about 7 until 7. And that's because I'm usually going to multiple congregations, I'm spending time fellowshipping, I'm there to be available for counseling, anointings, all these different things. And when the COVID restrictions hit, I was down to just one sermon. And we were able to still webcast out of this location. But even doing that only took about 3 hours on the Sabbath. Half an hour to drive here to be available to make sure everything got set up, an hour or so to give the sermon message, and then whatever we needed to put away, and then we were all gone. It was usually just a handful of people, literally. I did other pastor responsibilities, but all that changed. I couldn't go to hospitals. I couldn't go to assisted living facilities. I couldn't do a lot of visiting that I had done. And so all of that shifted. And the Sabbath as well became different for me. I had a Sabbath that I had not had for probably more than 2 decades because I wasn't up and obligated to spend the time that I had been for a lot of years. And I'm not complaining. I'm just saying it changed. The Sabbath day also became a day of more personal study for me because I had the time. Now I had the time. And while we can see the Sabbath and holy days as just a day of rest physically, they are more importantly to be days when we can focus on something more important, something more deep in our relationship with God and his people. This day is a day to sharpen our axe, if you will. You going back to the illustration I had in my introduction. Let's look at that principle and where I get my title from in Ecclesiastes 10. The value of taking care of equipment, taking the time to also be efficient in using the equipment, can be lost on a lot of people. This culture, as I said, is so driven by deadlines. It's so focused on productivity that we don't consider that downtime doesn't have to be wasted time, that it's actually an investment in doing better as we do the work that we have in front of us. Spiritually, it's no different. In Ecclesiastes 10, in verse 10, we find this principle. It says, if the axe is dull and one does not sharpen the edge, then he must use more strength, but wisdom brings success. If you don't keep an axe, or as I used in my illustration in the introduction, a chainsaw, if you don't keep those things sharp, then you're just simply using blunt metal to just whack away at the wood. That's exhausting. You can do it, but it will take a lot of time and you will wear yourself out. But the sharp axe certainly helps, and that's the wisdom. The wisdom brings success because you know where to put the effort. The effort is not in continually, you just put muscle behind it because eventually that will fatigue. The wisdom is knowing that if I take a pause here and sharpen this up, I'll actually spend less time doing it. Let's go back up one verse to verse 9, Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 9. He who quarries stones may not be hurt by them, and he who splits wood may be, I'm sorry, the first part is may be hurt by them, and he who splits wood may be endangered by it. Meaning you have to do it smart. You know, I've had trees on my property I've had to cut down, and I've had to just sort of stand there for 5 or 10 minutes and just kind of analyze the tree. Because it's not straight. It may grow out at an angle until it found sunlight, and now it's growing back the other way. How do you drop that safely? You can have trees that can have a twist in them. I had one tree that was busted by the wind because it had a weak spot in the tree. It was starting to die in a spot, and we had some really strong winds come through. Anson and I were actually standing outside the patio watching this wind and trying to put some things away before the wind got too bad. And we heard this loud crack, and we looked around, we couldn't see anything. I was expecting to see a tree split or fallen partially or something. Couldn't see it. A week or so later, I was mowing, and I happened to look up at this one tree, and it was a long split, probably about 20 feet along the side of this tree. How do you take that down safely? Because it can do all kinds of weird things when you start releasing that tension in the tree. This is what verse 9 is talking about. Spiritually, do we pay attention to these things as well? Not everything's about effort. Not everything's about pushing through. Sometimes we need to stop, and this is where meditation plays into our calling. We study God's word. We think about the principles. We ask God in prayer, and then we consider things. That's not wasted time. That's preparation time to be sharp in our acts, to be sure of what it is that God is asking us to do, and that we do it in the best way possible. Because it's not just us either. What if we hurt somebody? And whatever it is we do, something we say, something we don't do right, we can end up hurting other people, in fact. But taking the time to do things properly reduces that risk of being hurt. Because this world doesn't think that way. They don't consider some of these principles. But we can work smarter with the godly character we're taking on. Let's look next at Proverbs, not too far back from where we are now. Proverbs 20 and verse 29. Solomon here writes, he says, "The glory of young men is their strength, and the splendor of old men is their gray head." What is this proverb talking about? Young men have that fortitude, don't they? They have the muscles, they have the strength, they have the stamina, because they're young, full of them and vigor. What is the wisdom of old men in the gray hair? It's knowing how to use those young men with all that strength and vim and vigor. Right? The meme is, you know, that the old men get themselves in trouble thinking they're still young men. We still think that we're 20, right, in our minds, that we can still do a lot of these things that we probably shouldn't be doing because our body's not there. But strength fades with age, doesn't it? We like to think that it lasts forever, but it doesn't last forever. So wisdom should take over, to be smarter about how you do things, to know what you can and can't do. Spiritually, wisdom should take over as well. When we're called, when God begins to work with us, we have an energy because we're excited about what God is offering, what we're beginning to see that he's providing, the blessings that we can have in our life. And it can be very exhilarating. We have all this energy to go and do. But spiritually, we can't maintain that, can we? Any more than we can physically. That we need to learn wisdom in our calling as well. How best to handle things. In fact, sometimes, I'll come back to this thought in a little bit, sometimes the wisdom is knowing what is our problem and what isn't our problem. But the world around us is full of junk food, spiritually. And as that is not really food, it's empty calories, as they say. Spiritually, we can have things that are time wasters, distractors, empty fillers of time. And are we making the best use of our time? Are we making use of God's Sabbath day? This is not just an obligation that we check off and that we've satisfied for another week. God's Sabbath is the necessary pause at the end of the week to evaluate the important things of life. How did we do this past week? In business, they call that a postmortem. It sounds awful, but it's worth analyzing what you've just gone through. What can I learn? What did I not do very well? What can I do better? What did I do well and build on? The Sabbath is also a good use of the downtime, if you will, that we have to sharpen our spiritual acts for the weeks ahead. Let's look at 2 Timothy 2 next. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 15. Paul writes here to Timothy, "Be diligent to present yourself approved to God, a worker who does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth." Be diligent. The Authorized Version, the King James Version, says at the beginning there, "Study to show yourself approved." And the word used there in the Greek means to make haste, to exert oneself, or to give diligence. That doesn't mean we don't take a rest. It just means that it's consistent. Are we making the most of the time we have to become approved of God? The old expression that slow and steady wins the race. And I've seen people, I'm sure you have as well, over the course of their time, if you will, within God's church, they can come in really hot, but they can't sustain that. And if they try to, eventually they walk away, if that's all they have. Now is the time to be refocusing on being diligent. This is the redeeming the time that is also another scripture, making the most of what we have when we have it. I've noticed, unfortunately, a growing separation within God's people in this last year. COVID has changed the world, as I talked about earlier. But it's also impacted God's church. Some members initially began to thrive under some of this difference. They found that they had a lot of extra time on the Sabbath because they weren't driving to services. They weren't spending time with fellowship or having a potluck or meals afterwards or some of these things. And suddenly they could listen to three or four or more sermons on the Sabbath. They didn't have to get their family collected and dressed and everything put in the car and be off to church. They had time to do more Bible reading. But other members withdrew. Some took the time to call or write fellow members. They couldn't visit, but they would email, they would phone, they would do some of these things. But others began to see themselves as an island, that I can thrive. I don't need all of this other. They didn't call members, but they were often the ones complaining when no one called them. They're comfortable with listening to sermons online, but when that all changed, not everybody has come back. In Timothy, it says, be diligent. And diligence means to have a constant and earnest effort to accomplish what is undertaken. Doesn't mean we're flat out all the time. It just means that it's always there, being worked. And a sharp axe allows us to have constant and earnest effort in our Christian calling without becoming weary. I had one time chopping wood, because after you cut the logs, a lot of times you have to split them if they're of any good size in order to be able to use them in the fireplace and such. And one time I got a hold of a piece. I didn't cut it down, so I didn't pay attention to what it was. It was just in the pile. And I went to split it. And the way I would start it is you take an axe and you'd make a mark, and then you would set a wedge in the mark. Well, as I said, I hadn't paid attention. It was a piece of Osage orange. And if you're not familiar with that wood, it has no grain to it. It's just all woven. So you can't split it. You have to cut it. I didn't realize that until I had a wedge about half buried in this piece of wood, and it's not splitting. Now what do I do? I can't pull the wedge out because it's got too much pressure on it. So I had to get out the axe, and I had to start cutting it. But I had to pay attention, because if you hit the wedge with the axe, now you're dulling the edge of the axe. You got to go sharpen that. It just turned into this whole fiasco. Eventually, I got the wedge out. But it took so much effort, I made sure to never find another piece of Osage orange. Let's go to Galatians 6 next. The point is, you can work hard, or you can work smart and hard. And diligence means to put constant and earnest effort behind it. And Galatians 6 and verse 9 reminds us of the perspective we should have in doing this constant and earnest effort. Galatians 6 verse 9, let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we don't lose heart. And this is why I say to people on a regular basis, because it's easy for us to get discouraged, isn't it? Again, when we start out on our calling, we see so many things that now are different. The Sabbath day is now a priority instead of work. We see the holy days and tithing. We've changed our diet with the food laws and all of these things of understanding that God reveals to us. And it's easy to look at how much has changed. But when you're 20, 30, 40 years down the road, you think, well, I'm not making much progress. And oftentimes we are. It's just not as visible. Because it shifts from the external things to the internal things. And people can say, well, I'm not doing very well. And I remind them, as long as you're in the fight, you're there. This is what Galatians 6 verse 9 is talking about. To not grow weary while doing good. To have that diligence. So that it's constant and earnest. If we had a dial and it had up to 100. Maybe we're doing 65% effort energy. And that might seem like we're sort of dogging it a bit. But if you do that consistently, what's going to be the outcome? If you try to do 100, it's going to be unsustainable, sorry. And we may end up doing even less. What I learned far too late in life in those New England woods was that just working hard is tiring. It would seem obvious, but I guess it took me a while to pick that up. You can work hard, but it will be very tiring. working smarter can generate just as much output without becoming weary. Mr. Warren was not spent at the end of the day because he knew how to work the work. Let's go back a little bit here, Ephesians 5 and verse 15, just a chapter prior. Ephesians 5 and verse 15. See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise. Circumspectly involves wisdom, that you're paying attention. The word comes from meaning the perimeter, that we pay attention to things around us. Not as fools, but as wise. Verse 16, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. We're familiar with redeeming things, if not in a spiritual sense, physically. We probably all use coupons at some point, or you get an offer in the mail that if you bring in this flyer, you'll get a discount on whatever service it happens to be. That's the same thing. We're redeeming back what we would have paid. We're getting a discount in that regard. Redeeming can also mean to ransom or rescue from loss. And this is the point of the story I began with. When we take the time to sharpen our axe, we can actually accomplish more in less time. Spiritually, it's much the same. God's not asking for us to kill ourselves in doing what he's asking us to do. He's simply asking for us to be consistent. And why is that? What is the value of being consistent in God's calling? It changes who we are. Because as I've said in other messages, in the doing is the becoming. And the more you do something, the better you get at it. It's just axiomatic. If you're doing it right, you get better at it. And the other value is, you don't even have to really think about it very much, do you? Maybe you've been at a point in your position where if they hire somebody new, they've asked you to train this person. I had to do that after 5 years of being at that previous job before I was hired by the church. I'd gotten into a routine of how I did things. I knew where things were. I knew the processes I had established, and I knew what worked. Well, the new guy comes in to replace me, and I had to stop and think about what I did and why I did it. It had just become second nature. Instead of pushing through a trial, I would encourage you to take the time to see how God might be using that trial to develop his character in you. That's redeeming time as well. It might seem like we're doing nothing, that we should be in there trying to fix things or whatever happens to be. But what if maybe the first step is just to pause and go to God in prayer and say, what is it you want me to learn? That's no different than sharpening that axe. Maybe even on a physical level to make the most of it. As I said, our lives have changed. Years ago in New England, I had a huge commute. It took me at least an hour, 10 minutes or so to get to work in the morning. And it took me, depending on if there were any accidents or if there was a sports event or some other major thing in the city, it would take me an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes to get home in the evening. That's a lot of wasted time looking at the back end of somebody else's car. And so this was still the days of cassette tapes, and so I would get extra cassette tapes of sermons. I would listen to those. I would make the time of thinking of the prayer requests, making notes of what I would do later and other things that I needed to take care of spiritually and physically. The point is that I tried to even redeem that time. So do we make downtime to pray for one another? There have been times when I've been pressed in my responsibilities as a pastor, and I think, I don't have time for this. Whatever this is now coming and adding to my list of things to do, I don't have time for this. What I've learned over the years is that if I make time for the important stuff, God takes care of the rest. So the weeks that I needed to get a sermon together, and this has happened on more than one occasion, and someone needs something, and it's not just a frivolous thing. I need to serve someone. When I do that, the sermon oftentimes just flows. When I sit down to put it together, I'm not pushing through it. God just fills my head with the words, and I just type them out. There's no way to explain that if you've never been through it. But I hope that everyone has seen that in one shape or the other in your life. When you put the important things of God first, so many other things are taken care of. So as I said, make the downtime to pray for one another, to ask God to direct your steps, to ponder before God, to see what you've read in your Bible study, to even ask Him maybe what you should study, to see what's really and spiritually important in your life. Let's look at an example along this line back in 1 Kings 19. This is a great story. This is the account of Elijah. And what's notable about it is what preceded all of this. Elijah is now way down in the Sinai Peninsula now, fleeing for his life because Jezebel said she wanted to kill him. And he was motivated to get out of town. But what happened before all of that? He had had the, if lack of a better word, competition with the priests of Baal. And they'd spent the whole day dancing around and yelling and cutting themselves and doing all the things they were doing to try to get Baal to get involved and showing how powerful he was. And of course, nothing happened. And then they're done and Elijah's time turn comes. And so he tells them, load up the altar. They do. Now take buckets of water. And they just poured water and water and water till everything was soaked and it was running around the base of the altar. This was during a time of famine and drought. And so then he does that short, earnest prayer. It probably didn't take more than half a minute to say. God sends the lightning down and just consumes everything. There is literally nothing left. The sacrifice is gone. The wood is gone. The stones are gone. The water's gone. Everything's vaporized. And he seizes on the moment, Elijah does, to have the priests of Baal killed. Jezebel gets angry, as you can imagine she would, says that she's going to kill him. And so then he flees. Not just a little bit down the road. If you get out a Bible Atlas, it's close to 90 miles he ran. He wanted to be as far away from Jezebel as he could be. And so he gets down there, and you can imagine he's tired. I would be after running 90 miles. So God sends food. He sends the angel to take care of him. So he feeds him, he gives him water, and tells him to take a nap. I always like that. I use that principle. When you're in the middle of stress, nap is always a good place to start. And then he does it again. And then he starts asking Elijah all these questions. Why are you here? Like God didn't know? He's asking Elijah. He's wanting him to think internally. Why are you here? So in 1 Kings 19 and in verse 12, God has done all of these examples. This earthquake that he sent. I don't know if any of you have been through an earthquake. I've been through a couple of them. They can be unsettling, but it's amazing the power when you consider how everything's unsettled. Everything's moving. Things that are solid are now becoming liquid. And then God sends this fire, consuming fire. If you've ever been close to something really hot, the heat that radiates off of that, and just how consuming and even loud it can be when it's in the middle of all this. And so in verse 12, it says, after the earthquake, a fire came, but the Eternal was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. And I don't know if you've ever been in a really loud environment, and then suddenly it's quiet. It's almost unsettling because your senses have gone from being almost overloaded to now being deprived of anything. And it's very weird to go through that. And Elijah's there. So verse 13, so it was Elijah heard it. He heard this small voice. And it's a curious thing, too, that if someone's speaking really loud and then they start whispering, what do? What's the natural tendency? You lean in to listen. Because now it's different. You have to pay attention. So Elijah goes out, wrapped his face in his mantle. He stood in the entrance of the cave and suddenly a voice came to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? The point was not that Elijah didn't know. He wanted Elijah to understand, you're not in the right place. You still have work to do. Jezebel's not even an issue. And he gives him a list of things. If you would go on and read here, go take care of these matters, and sends him on his way. And it's not that God didn't care. Elijah had had his break. God was merciful, wasn't he? He could have, the moment Elijah got to where he was, he could have stopped him and said, back it up, buddy. Go back the other 90 miles. You're going the wrong way. I've got stuff for you to do. He let him sleep, gave him something to eat, something to drink. He let him pause. How many times do we need something like that in our lives? When God gives us the space to consider something. Even in terms of the agricultural cycle in the land of Israel, they didn't have wasted time. After the fall harvest, the fall holy days, that was the major event of the year. There were things to do in preparing the fields for the winter planting. The ground doesn't freeze there like it did here. You could put in winter grains, and so by the time of the spring holy days, they were ready to harvest. But even there, there was more to do. You would clear land that maybe you wanted to expand into. You would do maintenance on the fields. I see that here, even in the springtime. The farmer next to me runs his little bobcat around his field, picking up all the stones that have been heaved out of the ground from the frost. You don't want to run a tractor and plows and things over that. You'll damage all that equipment. But fields need to be plowed for winter crops, as I mentioned. You wanted to take care of when the rains would come. You wanted to time that and get things done that you needed to do to work around those things. Equipment needed to be serviced, repaired, repairing harnesses, sharpening scythes, all these sort of things. Even agriculturally, that's still done. So let's conclude in Mark chapter 2. Working smarter involves redeeming the time, making the most of what it is that God has given us. And that the fact of the matter is that nobody knows what time we have. We might think and hope that we would live to be 90, that we'll accomplish a lot, but we don't know how long we have, each of us individually. But whatever time we have, God wants to see what we're going to do with it. And it's not just a matter of quantity. It's a matter of quality. What will we do with it? I'm reminded of an account. Some of you may not know this name, but years ago, one of Mr. Armstrong's sons, his name was Dwight Armstrong. Richard, thank you. Richard, in talking with some of the senior pastors from decades ago, Richard was the one that got it, the way they put it. He was very sincere. He understood what Mr. Armstrong was teaching, believed it with his whole heart, was all about doing it. He died when he was 30. I think it was 2 days after he was involved in a car accident. He was out on a visiting program with another pastor. He wasn't driving, and I don't remember all the circumstances, but they were in a car accident. He was in the hospital. He ended up dying. That sucked so much wind out of the sails of the church at that time, because that was the first major death of that magnitude that had happened within the Worldwide Church of God. I asked Bob Fay, when he was relating one of these accounts to me, I said, why do you suppose God allowed that? And he said, well, for a number of reasons, but he recounted what I just mentioned. He said, he got it. And I think even though Richard might have only been 30, that God knew at that point. He already knew what Richard was going to be about, how he would function in his kingdom. And sometimes that can happen. Sometimes we don't come into church until we're much older. God still needs to see over time what we'll do. But in Mark 2, we come back to this aspect of the Sabbath day. Mark 2 and verse 27, this is the verse I alluded to earlier. Christ says to them, because the Jews had all this minutia tied up about the law, what you could do and couldn't do. And it wasn't just that they had the regulations. They also had the loopholes, which made no sense. If the law was that important, why would you look for the loophole? So, for instance, you could only travel, depending on the accounts, roughly about 2,000 cubits on the Sabbath day. After that, it was work. Okay, well, how do you get around that? Well, if I want to go a little bit further distance, I could leave something at somebody's house. Well, I have to go pick that up. I need it. So I don't start counting the 2,000 cubits until I get to the house. Okay, that's just silly, isn't it? I can't have anything in my pocket because I'm carrying stuff. That's work. It's just All of this silliness. This is why the Sabbath became onerous. How do you know if you're doing the right thing or when you're doing the wrong thing? So Christ reminds him here, the Sabbath was made for man. The Sabbath is a blessing for us. It's that pause that we need to take the time to back up and consider and sharpen our spiritual acts, to pay attention to the important things, to be reminded what is the important things, to take a break from the world, and to be reminded of the relationship that we have with God the Father. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The Sabbath day is about so much more than just a day of physical rest. It's a day to refocus on our relationship with God. It's a day to pause and to consider, to look back and to think about what we can do better, what we can be more a part of, and so forth. There's so much that we can do in this day, but it is a day to simply sharpen our axe.